that's the first time I really recognized film music as film music when I was age 13 or something. I was a big fan of dinosaurs. Magazine I read about the movie Jurassic Park that would be coming out and where you can see dinosaurs coming to life, and I was really excited about that. And so I went to a cinema with an uncle of mine, and I was completely overwhelmed by the combination of pictures and music. And when the helicopter flew over the island and there was this big fanfare with the big orchestra, and I thought, wow, I want to do that too. People want people to react to my music in the way I reacted to the music, and the combination music with the picture. From that time on, I really tried to get to know how to become a film composer.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman, which I hope inspires you through the personal stories of a fascinating diversity of musical guests. Christoph Zierngiebel is an award-winning German film composer who has composed music for over 120 films, as well as many TV series, including the Apple TV Plus series Where's Wanda? It often strikes me that even with something as specific as some of Christoph's advice about workflow for fellow film composers, that it can apply more broadly to all of us, whatever our pursuits. You'll be hearing a few clips from some of his projects in different musical styles, as well as his reflections on his formative student years, the strengths of the apprentice system, and his interest in many aspects of filmmaking. I've previously featured a few film composers on this series, and some of these episodes are linked directly in the show notes for you. It's such an interesting career path, and I find that each of these composers have unique musical backgrounds. Like all my episodes, you can watch this on my YouTube channel or listen to the podcast on many platforms, and I've also linked the transcript to my website, leahroseman.com. It's a joy to bring these inspiring episodes to you every week, and I do all the many jobs of research, production, and publicity. Have a look at the description of this episode, where you'll find timestamps and all the links, including different ways to support this podcast. Hi, Christoph. Thanks so much for joining me here today.
Alia, thanks for having me.
I was talking to my husband over breakfast about this interview, and he asked who you were. And I said this little bit about Jurassic Park changing your life. And he said, oh, you should ask him if he ever contacted John Williams. So that's my first question.
I never dared to be honest, because he is a very busy man. And actually, it's funny, I never thought about that. Maybe I should do it, because he's getting quite old, and yeah. But a friend of mine who's a conductor is conducting lots of his film music live to picture. Maybe there's a connection.
Yeah. So actually, do you want to tell us that story of how, you know, you saw that movie?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the first time I really recognized film music as film music when I was age 13 or something. I was a big fan of dinosaurs, and in a magazine I read about the movie Jurassic Park that would be coming out and where you can see dinosaurs coming to life, and I was really excited about that. And so I went to a cinema with an uncle of mine, and I was completely overwhelmed by the combination of pictures and music. And when the helicopter flew over the island and there was this big fanfare with the big orchestra, and I thought, wow, I want to do that too. I really want people to react to my music in the way I reacted to the music, and the combination music with the picture. And that was the idea that got stuck in my head. And from that time on, I really tried to get to know how to become a film composer, which was not that easy at that time. There's no internet, and I grew up in a small village, so no connection to film composers, stuff like that. So was not that easy to go down that road.
But at this point, you've written well over 120 scores for film and TV.
Seems like it, yes. Quite a lot, yeah.
Yeah, Jurassic Park is a score that my orchestra played with the movie. It's like I think a lot of orchestras have been doing that. Mm-hmm. And it has such a huge effect on the audience, of course, to hear the orchestra live. But I was just thinking, you know, when you saw it in the theater, it's not as popular now. People aren't actually watching movies in theaters so much. And it's felt much more of an impact for the music.
Absolutely. Yeah, And I hope people that cinema will survive in a way, because it's such an immersive experience, and you are so focused and immersed in the story, and which doesn't happen when you watch movies at home. Mm-hmm. The big screen and the big sound system, and it's just a completely different world, and taking you out of your world, which no streaming service can do in, mm-hmm. in this way. So up till today, I think it's a really magical place, the cinema. Every time you leave your comfort zone, which is your home, and go somewhere else and experience art in its purest form, it's a good thing to do, and it's very, very inspiring, I think.
So before we get into some of your music, I was interested to talk to you a little bit about your childhood, because actually you're the first German I've had on this podcast. I've had people from over 30 countries, just hadn't got around to Germany. So also, you know, you grew up in this village, and one of the things I read is that you played in your dad's brass band that he conducted, which is mm-hmm. like the community band. Is that right?
Right, right.
This is not something that exists everywhere. So I was curious about that cultural aspect.
Ah, I see. Okay, so it's just a group of non-professional musicians who normally gather around a leader who is more versed in music, and they play all the church parties, or the community parties, or there are parades or stuff like that. So a lot of occasions, and they play a lot of German traditional music and also American traditional music that is like marches, concert marches and stuff like that. And actually my father's community band still exists, and they have a partner orchestra in Iowa, in Boone.
Oh.
And they shared scores and played concerts together. So it's a really cool cultural thing and very important for a village's community. People coming together and not just playing football or doing sports, which is quite common, but also playing music together, which is a really important aspect for people to come together, I think.
Mm-hmm. And another thing that struck me when I was researching you was that you were able to write the music for your high school play. It's sort of a first gig.
That's right, yeah. Because I was always into music and not so much into the normal school things. And that's where my German teacher approached me whether I was interested to write music for some poem that was used inside a theater play, which ended up me writing a complete score for the school play, and that I think saved me also my high school exams, because I wasn't really that good at maths or the other stuff that you have to be good at when you attend school, and so that was my really first experience in music interacting with a story, and of course there was, the people were happy that I wrote music, and there was no really criticism about it. There was it's the case today when you write music for a movie, it's always an interaction with the director or producer, and that wasn't the case at that time. Mostly people just were happy I wrote music, and it was placed in the theater place, and that was a really cool experience. Did it, I think, for about 4 years.
And you had access to a digital audio workstation for that project.
I think that was one of the points that also made me interesting for as a collaborator, because I was able to sketch out my ideas without any big, without needing any logistics of musicians or something like that. I just recorded some stuff at home or at school. Brought my own microphone and recorded a cello player or a singer or something like that, and it was really not just pop songs or something like that. It was quite film music like music at that point. Mm-hmm. And what was quite interesting that at one point I was able to transcribe the music and get it performed at one of the concerts we had at school. So being able to listen to my music played by live musicians then the other way around was a really important experience for me. to see that people actually know what I'm feeling, what kind of music I'm having in my head, and they can actually play that. I was not very versed at writing down notes. It was a back and forth process, but I learned a lot, and I really caught fire then, and I thought I really have to do that. The other aspect that's interesting is why I wanted to become a composer is that I never was a really good musician. I wasn't into practicing and studying Mozart or Bach or something like that. I always wanted to write my own stuff and never got into practicing really, which is really a shame because I wish I really could play the piano properly or the drums properly, but I always thought I can write and other people can play it, so I don't have to practice. That was another reason for getting into composing.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, you write an incredible range of music, and often in one project as well. Mm. There has to be this quick pivot. And so in this playlist we're going to be sharing, what should we start with? Let's see. The Flight of Brian is a really inspiring
yes.
story. Maybe you want to tell us that story a little bit.
Yeah, it's been about 2 years since I worked on this project, so I will see if I can tell you a lot about it. It's a really inspiring story about the first man-powered flight and about a guy that flew a plane that was just that had no engine or something. It was basically a bike. Where he was, he's sat on a bike and there's a propeller or something that was driven by the bike, and then he got over the English Channel, which is quite a distance to go, and it was a challenge back then. You could win prize money when you did the challenge, and it's a very inspiring story because it took a really long time, and it was the team that set up this plane were all. You would nowadays you would diagnose them with neurodiversity, something like that. So they were all no engineers, but they were very passionate about what they wanted to do and very focused. So they built that plane over the course of over a year or something, and then got from America to England and set up the plane that. In the end, made their way over the English Channel, and the director is this. I worked with the director before on a Netflix documentary called "Scandal: Bringing Down Wirecard," which was quite a different story and was more a thriller-like story. And "Flight of Brian" is somehow a complete opposite because it's more like a very band-driven score. It's about funky music, heavy bass lines, Motown horn sections and stuff like that. And so it was really big fun doing this music and also connecting it with this weird story of those non-engineer guys doing this absolutely insane adventure. It's a really fun movie to watch. And I think it's in the US. You can watch it on Amazon Prime. So do check it out. It's really worth it.
Thanks for that.
This is a clip from The Flight of Brian.
Let's talk about Where's Wanda. So that's mm-hmm. It's very cool. So I just started it. I'm into
All right.
the, And I understand you composed some episodes, or is it co-composed with Ralph?
Yeah, Ralph composed the first episode on his own, and then from episodes 2 to 8, we composed it 50-50. Okay. So it's a teamwork from then on, yeah.
Yeah, I'm really glad I found out about that show. And it's interesting in terms of the cultural landscape of TV now. Mm-hmm. So for Apple Plus, this is their first German show.
Right.
I was just thinking Netflix, one of their successes, I think, has been getting productions from all over the world and getting those audiences hooked. So it's Absolutely. A good move, I think, on Apple's part.
It is. I think they have shows from England and Spain already, but this was the first German one, and I was really excited about working with Apple TV, because I really like their shows. I mean, Severance is one of my all-time favorite.
Yes.
and all those heroes of mine, like Theodore Shapiro or Lorne Balfe or all those big guys doing the music for the shows, and then then there's my name alongside Ralph's in that canon of really great artists. That was really something for me.
And this mythical creature, the Nupelvoken, is this a real thing? Or
no, I never heard about it before. And it's also a very funny name. It doesn't mean anything. And I think it's just how people outside German consider German words to be. So it's a really funny thing.
And in this score, you guys have some songs with English lyrics. Are they written for the show, or are they licensed? How does that work?
Mm-hmm. No, the songs have been licensed all. Okay. We just wrote the musical score the without the lyrics.
I was just curious about that aspect.
Yes.
But sometimes for some projects, you'll be asked to write in the style of somebody in order to avoid licensing, correct? For that sort of thing?
Didn't happen that often to me. I mean, I got asked to write songs because I like to write songs, and my wife is also a singer and lyricist, so it's something I can offer to productions. And there's something... sometimes it happens that there is a song they want to license and they can't, and... But I don't like to write soundalikes or something like that. I just mm-hmm. try to convey the emotional impact of the song and write and translate it into my own language. I think that's more interesting than just doing something that sounds like Stairway to Heaven or something like that.
Yeah. But, you know, I was thinking about in terms of what the creator wants, it must have happened in your long career that they just don't like it. And you have to completely change your idea. Like, you think it's great, and they're just, no.
Yeah, it happens all the time, especially in TV. And I have to say, it's nothing. I think it's really, there's nothing really wrong with that. Because to talk about music is really, really hard. And I always try to make the director talk to me like he's talking with an actor, like more about emotionality and dramaturgical aspects of scenes and movies, not so much about the music as music, because there are a lot of things you can, the vocabulary of non-musicians, maybe you know that, is not always the same in line with how professional musicians and composers talk about music. I mean, best example is someone always talked about horns and really meant trombones. Or, I mean, mm-hmm. there's also this jazz and classic vocabulary. So much things you can really make not be on the same page very quickly. So it's better to talk about emotionality and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But also, when directors talk to you about emotionality, there's a lot of ways how to approach it, and so it's a process, and it sometimes takes time to find the right language for a movie or for a scene, or the right instrumentation. Or I mean, if you have an orchestral score, it's kind of easier, because there are of course a lot of stylistics and how to orchestrate things, but the general sound is pretty clear, and you know how an orchestra sounds, and there are different settings of an orchestra and sizes, but the core sound is always the same. And when you go into a different direction and want to write a more synthetic sound or creating sounds from scratch, it's much more difficult to meet expectations unless you have a really strong temp track, which is the music the director puts under the first edits of his movie to show to people what the emotional direction is he wanted to go with the movie. And sometimes that is helpful in order to find the right sound for the movie. But it really sometimes is really a journey, and I also like the process of throwing things away and starting from scratch and trying things out, because often there's not so much time when scoring a movie, and you go for first or second idea you have when seeing the movie, and it's just because you have to start and you write the music, and if then someone gives you the chance to revisit the scene and say it doesn't work for me, try something different, it can also be very rewarding, because maybe it's you just think the music isn't the best music you could write for the movie, but because of the time you just go for the idea. And so to make it short, I really don't mind starting from scratch or throwing away ideas. It's just part of the process, and it always helps you understanding the story and the emotionality of the movie a bit more. So when writing the second or third iteration of an idea, it's often easier because you know all the other aspects of the movie. You know the rhythm of the edits, and you know every movement of the actors. Maybe much easier to write a second or a third iteration.
And music's always the last thing, right?
Kind of, yeah. Alongside with sound design, or even visual effects, we are at the very end of the process. Yes, right.
And Christoph, I was just thinking about TV shows as opposed to movies in terms of the story arc. Certainly in the last 20 years, you know, even a show like Where's Wanda? I mean, it's like this big development. And I tend more towards a series than a movie for that reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know what you mean, because it's you can take a much deeper dive into the characters. And that can be quite interesting if the series is really good. But it also can be really frustrating if it doesn't lead anywhere in the end, which happens a lot of times.
This is a clip of Where's Wanda?
So when you went to this, you went to a very competitive program in Munich, where you live now, for TV and film composition. Mm-hmm. And your mentor, Andreas Weidinger, he helped you a lot. You ended up assisting with him.
Right.
But can you talk about those early days when you first got there and what that was like?
Yes. I mean, before I was entering that program, I started studying music teaching at another university because I wanted to do something safe, but I learned pretty quickly that it's not my kind of thing. I mean, I have really good teachers, and they are very passionate about what they do, and that's, I admire that a lot, but it's absolutely not my kind of thing. So then I learned about the program in Munich, and I learned that they only accept students once another student has graduated. And they only have 7 slots. So I thought I'd just go for it. And if I got accepted, it's a sign. And I should go down that route. So and I was accepted, luckily. And I really liked the student's life. And because we were the University of Music in Munich is a really big but also intimate place, and there's rooms filled with awesome musicians, and if you have an idea, you just open the next door. You quickly grow friends with violin players, harpists, percussionists. You can try out stuff you write and ask them how to write it down so they can understand it quicker and stuff like that. So it was really a dream place for me. And we had a studio with lots of equipment where we were able to record musicians and also small ensembles and a recorded choir, a recorded small string ensembles for student films. And it was all supervised by our professors. And this was a really great time. And the only thing missing a bit was the connection with the film. There's also a film school in Munich, but there never was that of a big connection between those two. Because at the time, those students were didn't like the way what they called the big Hollywood music, because they wanted to make different movies and more in the art house field and with no music or very 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 small amount of music, so it was hard to make a connection there. But one of my best friends till today, I knew him from school. Was accepted there, and I did all the music for all his movies up until now, and that was one of the really great exceptions there.
Yeah. So I was curious, in your role as assistant, and you use assistants mm-hmm. now, what do you think is the best way to train people or to make use of that help?
It depends. It highly depends on the people, but I mean, at the university, I learned a lot of the theoretical stuff, but the important part is to experience the process of writing music for a film, the time pressure, and all the different aspects aside from composing, because composing is a maximum. It's half of the story. You have to do a lot of organizational stuff and technical stuff, and it's also a very psychological job, because you have to find out who is the leader in the film team and who tells you what you should go after and stuff like that. So it's very complex, and you can't learn that at university. You only learn that while you're in the job. And of course, you can do students' film where you're on your own, but being assistant to somebody who is in that role is there's a kind of a safe zone where you can experience stuff without being responsible on your own, and that's a very very healthy way approaching the job, and you learn a lot of things and avoiding mistakes you could easily make and which can be very discouraging at some point. I mean, you also have to learn to deal with rejection and stuff like that. Experiencing that secondhand through my mentor was one of the most valuable experiences I had, and I try to make it possible for my assistant too. And I also with Andreas for some time we shared studio plays, and we often had some assistants we shared and gave them the opportunity to do the same like I did and just dip their toes into the shark mm-hmm. water of film music business. And I think it's very important for people to have that safe zone without being responsible on their own.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking about young Christoph, because if you look back, like you did get in when you first applied, mm-hmm. but maybe if you hadn't, but you knew you had this drive and this talent, do you think you would advise him to try again? Like just keep working and...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There's few things I would avoid, but I think the most things, even the bad things, were really helpful during my path of becoming a big composer, and they really shape the way I work and the way I think about music and films. I would say just go for it, try it out.
You know, when we started this conversation, I asked you about if you'd ever connected with John Williams, but I was thinking about networking, because the mm-hmm. internet's really changed the landscape.
That's
and
right.
And I know you've done some workshops on productivity for film composers, mm-hmm. for example. And being in Munich, I mean, you're reaching out to people all over in this business.
It has changed, but the workshops were in person at film music congresses.
Okay.
I want to do it online at some point too, because and it's not fancy stuff. It's just stuff that composers don't want to think about in the first place, but it's so important to get your stuff organized so you have time to compose, or especially have time to spend time with your family. I mean, I have two kids and a wife, of course, and it's inspiring and important to spend time with them. It's important for them, but it's also important for me to get away from the studio and away from movies and just sitting outside in the garden and playing with sand or playing with playing ball or stuff like that, just reconnecting with the real life. And this is very important. It's healthy, it's inspiring, and to have time for that, it's really important to have an organized workflow, and so you really can enjoy the time off studio without thinking about stuff. Oh, I have to do that, I have to write that email, I have to send those files. And I never thought about that this could be interesting for other people, but especially when working with Ralph and Where is Wanda, and I also helped other composers with their projects, and I learned that things that were quite normal and natural for me aren't normal and natural for other composers at all. So I put together this little speech, and it was amazing how the reactions of the people were, because the never thought about some very simple things, or thought about them, but never knew how to organize it or approach it. And it's really a great feeling to add value to other people's workflow, or other people's life, even to give back the things that I learned from Andreas and other people. So I really want to pass it on to a new generation of people.
Hi, just a quick break from the episode. I wanted to let you know about some other episodes I've linked directly to this one, with film and TV composers Adam Blau, Anja Roseman and Cara Talve, Kat Rayorendi, Pat Irwin, Emily Sankofa, and Colin Aguar. It's a joy to be able to bring these meaningful conversations to you, but this project cost me quite a bit of money and lots of time. Please support this series through either my merchandise store or on my Ko-fi page. You'll find the links in the show notes. For the merch, it features a unique design by artist Steffi Kelly, and you can browse clothes, notebooks, mugs, and more, everything printed on demand. On my Ko-fi page, you can buy me one coffee or every month. You'll also find the link to sign up for my newsletter, where you'll get access to exclusive information about upcoming guests. Finally, if you're finding this episode interesting, please text it to a friend. Thanks.
Can you share like one or two tips from that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, some pretty simple things is organizing the folder structure of a project. I have an empty folder structure that I always copy to a project folder when starting a new project. It's very simple, because you have dedicated folders for dedicated files, for pre-film sketches, for the compositional stuff you do, you compose to the movies, and then for stuff that goes out to producers or directors for approval, and to the dubbing studio where the final music gets to get mixed into the movie. And that's one very simple way of staying organized, and also finding your stuff very quickly, and not just think, what was the last version I sent to who, to the producer, or which version is he talking about, something like that. So it starts with those very simple things, and then going over to cue sheet organizations, cue sheets, a list of the music that is included in a movie, and keeping track of the different versions and the recordings you have to do and stuff like that. So it's pretty complex job in a way, but so it's really important to have a workflow that helps you have an overview over the work you have to do or you already did in one place very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically what it's about.
You know, it points to some of the many skills you need to have to do your job. And I was thinking back to when you said you were in school and you were struggling with other subjects, but you just wanted to mm-hmm. do this. But had you been in a educational environment where you were able to just follow your curiosity and maybe not do all the traditional stuff would have been even better, right?
I don't know. Yeah, maybe, but I think maybe it's only possible because I went all the way up to until now to learn those skills. I didn't know. I don't know whether I would have been. I didn't have that knowledge back then, and not the curiosity. I mean, I always was interested in workflow and stuff like that because my father had a little company also, which grew bigger, and logistics company then later on. And I think there's some stuff I learned from him subconsciously, and that was what finds its place in my workflow right now. And but it really took some time to for myself to really realize how to organize things, especially when at the point when I got a regular assistant, you have to set up things so that other people can understand where you're at, which part of the project you're working on, and also which tasks they have to do, and that's really changed my mindset and my workflow, and so I think I wouldn't have been able to show it to people earlier in my life.
Yeah, as you know, as a podcaster, you know, I do everything myself, and if I ever had anyone helping me, it would be complicated to explain because maybe it's not so logical. It's a little chaotic. My organization.
Can imagine that. Yes. But yeah. you absolutely know where all your stuff is, and you understand your workflow, yeah. and that's fine. That's worked for me for 10 years, but then there was some point where I thought, no, I really have to reorganize things, especially when I revisited older projects and I couldn't find the latest files. And yeah, because when you're into the project, you always know where everything is, but a year later, you won't remember that. And it's quite hard to revisit stuff.
That is a good point. I mean, I think for just general organization in life, you know.
Absolutely, yeah. But I'm not very organized in my general life. If I won't show you my studio right now. But I try to be organized in my job at least.
Yeah. So The Unexpected Journey was a special personal project.
Yes. It's just one orchestral track I recorded for my 40th birthday, which is, I think, 5 years ago. And we had some time left in an orchestral session I did for a comedian here in Germany. And I thought maybe I'd just bring along that piece because I wrote it for a pitch. So I wrote it for a pitch and I didn't get the project, and also the piece didn't make it to the pitch. But it was a melody that always resonated a lot with me, and that doesn't happen a lot of times because you have to write such a lot of music, and to really connect with it on a deeper emotional level is often not that easy. But there was this melody, and I really loved it. And at this point, I also wasn't able to write orchestral scores, because writing for orchestra is one of my favorite things, and I was doing a lot of thriller music during that time, which was very electronic driven. So I decided for my 40th birthday, I just have to do it for myself and just give it a go and record it. And that is what got the single release, The Unexpected Journey, which also led me to new orchestral projects, funnily, because I sent it to a production company, searched for a composer for an animated movie that was The Hero of Zootopia, and I got the gig. And so it really gave a new twist to my career in a way, because I knew I wanted to go in that direction, but in Germany, orchestral scores aren't that common. So I had to search for different ways.
What a beautiful story.
Thank you.
Part of it would be style, though, in terms of the, as well as budget, in terms of not using orchestra.
Yeah, of course. A big part of it is style. And it's also the way streaming services work and the stories work in streaming services that mostly don't need orchestral music. Not that much music, and more atmospheric music maybe, and not so much themes, but more sounds and stuff like that. Yeah. And that's all fine. I also like to do that in a way, but I always was about me personally. It was really personally. It was more about having a great melody or a great theme, or even in music like Stravinsky, who doesn't work with big themes like in Marvel movies, like you hear in Marvel movies, but there was always something motivic driven stuff, and I really like that kind of music. And of course you can translate this into electronics somehow too, and work with little motifs, but it's, I think orchestra is it's such an interesting and never ending story to write for orchestra, because every time I record with orchestra, and I did about 30-35 orchestra sessions, and for different occasions, movies and arrangements, and I played live with orchestras and stuff like that, and every time I learned something new. It's so fascinating, and even working with different players, and each orchestra has its own character in a way, and it's just so exciting to explore that territory.
Mm-hmm. Germany's known to have one of the, maybe the strongest support of anywhere in the world for orchestras. Mm. There's been some cutbacks, I understand, in the last generation, but do you feel it's still pretty robust?
Well, I'm not an expert on that field, but it feels very robust in comparison to other countries, of course, yes.
Yeah.
Because we have states-funded orchestras here. And I mean, I was part of a military orchestra for 2 years, which then got, what do you call it? It doesn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. They cut down the number of military orchestras, and I think that happened to the community and states orchestras too, but not in such a big way. And I think we can really be happy about that, because we have some really great orchestras here in Germany, here in Munich especially, and in Berlin, and so I think it's something to be proud of. Yeah.
I spent some time in Munich a long time ago. I remember you have that beautiful English garden, and I think it's the same landscape designer as Central Park, right?
I don't know. Maybe, yes.
I think so. Yeah, it struck me as a very, very livable city, because you've stayed in Munich. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a lot of green, and I live at the end of the city, and there's a forest around the corner, and it's really beautiful. But and it's also in a way small compared to other big cities in Germany, which I also like. I mean I've been to Los Angeles, for example, and it's just unbelievable how big this city is, and even compared to Berlin, which is also a very big city, but it's a never-ending landscape of houses, and quite overwhelming for a village guy like me, but also a very inspiring place, of course. And Munich seems to be the perfect place in between the really big cities and smaller villages. So I feel quite comfortable here, yeah.
So you had mentioned carving out family time as a priority. And other film composers I've talked to have said it can be so unrelenting, the deadline pressure. But you do have a very strict work schedule for yourself, like that's very full on during the day, right?
Yeah, I think we should add my wife now
for
that topic to see if I'm right. But normally I really try to work. I bring my daughter to school, and my wife brings our son to the kindergarten, and then we start working at around 8:30, and pick her up at school at 2, which is a nice break and getting out, because I can do it all by foot, so it's also very healthy. And then I stop working at 6 o'clock in the evening when we have dinner. And I learned that in a masterclass with Michael Cecchino in Spain. It's quite some time ago. I think it was 2009 or something. Where he told us that the most important thing for him is to have breakfast with his family and to have dinner with his family, and everything is wrapped around that schedule. And I thought that's quite interesting, because you spend a lot of time procrastinating, and if you have a set time frame, that can be really annoying at times, of course, because you want to stay in the flow or something, and but it also can be quite relieving, because if you are out of ideas and you know at 6 o'clock I can go up and be away from the studio, and there's a new day tomorrow, and I can start with a fresh mind, and that's really very helpful. And but it's also very hard to do this during really tight schedules, because you know, you have to stay on time and you have to deliver and to make a break, and not using all the time you have up until the deadline is really tough. But over the years I learned that I never missed a deadline, so why should I miss this deadline just because I'm having dinner with my family? It doesn't make sense. So over the years I try to stay in that time frame. Sometimes it's I have to work over weekends and stuff like that, but I really try to avoid it. And and that's why I also am very fast most of the time writing stuff, because it's very focused. And also spending time off the studio, it always helps, because my mind is working on the score when I'm sitting at dinner or sitting playing with my kids or something. My mind is still working on ideas subconsciously, and once you get back to the writing desk, there are new aspects that come up that wouldn't be there if you hadn't spent time off the desk. So I think it's a really important aspect and cannot be underestimated.
So the hero of Centopia, writing a kid's a score for a kid's animated feature having young children, must sort of change your view of it than when you were younger writing something like that.
Yeah, that's right. It's all about the perspective. I mean, I wrote for children's movies earlier before I had kids, and writing for kids movies always a lot of fun, because it's you can't do stuff you can't do with grown films for grown-ups most of the time, and especially with animation you really you can go rogue and can write music that doesn't make sense in any other context. And with The Hero of Centopia, it was really a dream project. And also working with people that are into animation is a quite different workflow than working with fiction people, because they it's all about imagination. They work with very raw sketches from the beginning, and then over the course of 1 or 2 years the film takes shape, and everything before that taking shape is all in about imagination. It's all in our head. The movie doesn't exist. You can't go out with a camera and shoot the movie. It just takes a lot of time to draw everything into animate stuff. It's a really long process, and that's why you really are in a zone of imagination, and that's really connecting them very much with the mind of a composer, because you also everything is in your head, and you have to sketch it out, write it down, and do demos and stuff like that. So the process is very similar, and that's why I felt quite a great connection with the animation crew. And and also animated movies ask a lot for orchestra stuff, and I really always wanted to write something like The Hero of Centopia, and was really happy to get the chance to. And also writing some 80s infused stuff, for example, the Flight of the Storm Unicorn is one of those tracks that is kind of the direction of Never Ending Story, if you know that music, written by Klaus Doldinger, a German film composer. And so a lot of things that just felt right and made a lot of fun, and I'm really happy how it turned out.
This is a clip from The Hero of Centopia.
Thank you.
nobody knows yet, but I'm working on a new project with the same crew, so here we are.
Wonderful. I was curious about a few things. Some of the media composers I've spoken with are interested in filmmaking themselves. And I was just curious if, let's say you had a parallel life, like, you know, fantasy world, would you be interested in direction or writing or acting or any other aspect? Because you know the industry so well.
Yeah, I mean, I would be highly interested in directing, to be honest, because it's very hands-on working with people on set and really, it's really an art form. It's also very technical, like film composing in a way, because you know have to know all the camera stuff, the lenses and lighting and everything. But it's so interesting when you look through a camera and just have this focused space out of the big setting, and you can carve out a story out of this small. It's really fascinating. And also working with actors, it's like working with musicians, telling them what you want the story to the emotionality of the story should be, and then letting them do their thing, like a really good musician who knows to interpret a melody or interpret a line or something. It's the same with actors. So I think being a director would be really some interesting thing. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed.
Yeah. It's such a benefit to people to immerse themselves in storytelling. Like, I think that you can't, people maybe take for granted that there's all this great content to watch. But, you know, a lot of us are going through pretty tough times now in the world, and just being able to escape into story.
Yes. Yeah, I think what I recently discovered, which is of course somehow quite obvious, is reading books, because it's you stay inside one focused story and not just scroll through amounts of stuff, and which is it's not giving you back something. It's just spending time, and afterwards you just don't know what did you watch, or. I mean, unless you watch something like your podcast on YouTube, which is a longer form, and you stay with it and stay focused and watch the whole episode, it's really just spending 10-second times with a lot of stuff. So reading a book it's better for the eyes in terms of healthiness, but it's also much deeper connection with the story or the topic of the book, and staying in a topic for over the course of some days or hours at least, is something very rewarding and also something very refreshing for the soul, I think. And also it's like listening to a symphony in a whole. People don't do that. I mean, people even don't listen to songs that are longer than 2.5 minutes, or listening to an album of songs, like concept albums of stuff like that. And I think that's really something that could help us just focus in on some specific things that interest us and just spend time with them and not scroll through 1,000 videos of different aspects of life and politics and stuff like that. It's you get tired and it doesn't give back something that's really useful for you in life, I think.
Have you just got back into reading books, or is it sort of a new thing?
Yeah, my friend I talked about, who was is a director. He wrote his first book, which he spent quite a lot of time and writing. And I knew part of the story because it's a kind of autobiographical, and it's also some aspects of the book are included in the movie Finisterre, which we also did. And so and that's how I really learned that reading books, I mean, might seem quite ridiculous for people that are more into the arts and stuff like that, because it's so obvious having a good bookshelf with some of the classics or interesting topics. It's such an obvious thing, but especially if you have a family and it's fast-paced life as a film composer, it's really hard to really take the time to sit down and read in a book for an hour or something. There's time for that, and one is exhausted quite a lot, and it really takes takes energy and focus to do that, but it's so rewarding. And that's the thing I really want to, because in the early days I really read a lot of books. I spent my youth reading all the day, and it's really good for imagination, because you can make your own movies in your head about the stories you read. And it's so important, such an important aspect of life, imagination in general. Yeah. And reading books really helps a lot with that, I think.
Yeah, I've always been a reader, but, you know, with the pace of my life now, I maybe only read 20 minutes a day. Like, I don't have necessarily an hour to sit, but I think it's, I do see certainly, I think with the younger generation coming up now, people maybe never even developed that habit because they grew up with the internet, which is kind of sad. Anyway, you had mentioned Finisterre, this project, and there's music from that we could include for people to hear.
Yes, that's right. It was a really special project because it's a movie you can't watch now anywhere, because it's a very small art house movie, and my friend Konstantin traveled the world for I think 7 years and interviewed and filmed people who live in communist regimes like Cuba or Venezuela or even in Germany, in Berlin, the story of the communist regimes. And the movie is held together by a very poetic voiceover text. It's like a 1.5-hour poem. And we had the chance to make this a live experience. So I wrote, I think it was 88 minutes of score, and it was there was a film premiere in a theater in Regensburg, which is a small town in the north of Bavaria. And we got the score performed live to the picture. We had a big orchestra and choir, and was, I think, 120 people on stage in total. And it was quite a unique experience, because it was, people didn't know the movie. Normally you watch something like Jurassic Park or Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter, and you know the film inside out, and you just want to experience it once again. And initially the theater approached me because they heard some music of mine in the radio, and they wanted to do a kind of a film concert with a movie I already did. And I asked them, but you're a theater, how about trying something new? And we just do this as an artful experience and show the people a movie they don't know and music they don't know, and just see how people react. And it was only two concerts, but it was sold out very quickly and was very successful. People were very overwhelmed. And for Konstantin and me, it was a very, very special experience, of course. I mean, we recorded orchestral scores for his movies, but the live experience and sitting in a room with people and seeing them react, and people started crying. It was very moving and very rewarding, I think. And it's really a pity so far we couldn't get another concert of this project. Maybe we'll have the chance once again.
This is an excerpt from Finisterre.
And there's beautiful vocal music in that. I'm curious, being married to a singer, has that affected your development of writing for voice?
Yeah, I mean, I was always interested in the human voice, and And as the movie is about the voice of the people, of the common people in a way, it was quite natural using the voice as a musical element in the score too. But yeah, it has sharpened my understanding a bit, being married to my wife. Is not a professional singer in that sense, but she has a classical education, and but we also had a pop band. So again, I learned a lot writing for her and for the registers of her voice, and which helped me gain a deeper understanding of writing for voice in general and working with choir, which I always loved. And so yeah, it was always there, but it absolutely helped me gaining more experience with that. Yeah,
I was just, this Finisterre, you said it's not available. Why doesn't he put it on Vimeo and people can rent it there?
We have to ask him.
Yeah, you should know. Do that. Yeah,
yeah. I think the biggest problem, if you may call it so, is that we don't have the money to dub it, to record the voice in the different language.
Oh.
Because it's a very poetic text, and it's not easy to translate it. I mean, I think there is an English version he translated, but you have to record it, and it's a really tedious process to get it right in terms of pronunciation and the flow, so it really fits the music. And yeah, but we are definitely thinking about that. He now has also two kids, and so you know,
yeah,
life is in the way a bit. And but yeah, I think we will do that at one point.
Mm-hmm. There's one little cultural thing I wanted to ask you about. On
sure.
Instagram, you posted something about Stollen, this pastry.
Yes.
And that, okay, because there's a bakery near me that has it once a year. And you
oh,
said
wow.
it has, mm-hmm. you said it has to ripen. What's with this?
Yes.
What do you mean by this?
I mean, there are, I learned that there are several recipes to do it. But my sister does it in a way you have to make the Stollen, and then you have to put it in foil. Or what do you call it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and take it into a dry place and wait for 2 weeks. It's like wine, which
ferment.
Has to
okay.
ferment in a way. Yeah, right.
Okay.
And then it's ready to eat. But it really takes a chemical process, and which instead of putting it into the oven, you put it in the shelf and wait for 2 weeks, and then it's ready to eat.
It's delicious. Can you describe it to people who've never tasted it?
Wow, that's like talking about music. It's really tough. Well, it's sweet, but it's also very fruity in a way. And there's, what's the English word for it? Marzipan?
Almonds,
yeah.
Marzipan.
Yeah. Almonds, yeah, which I love, really love. And there's a small part in the inside of the Stollen is marzipan. And yeah, it's just really delicious. I really look forward to it because it's nothing that, as you said, at one time of a year you can eat that, and then for the rest of your year it's gone. It's not available, and it's such a rewarding thing that something is not available all the time, and you can really look forward to something. It's
yeah.
also a very healthy process in nowadays world.
When I was just finished my studies, the first time I went to Europe actually was to play in the Schleswig-Holstein Festival in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one of my memories is we'd finished playing concerts a couple times, and these small children would come up on stage and give us marzipan because one of the sponsors was like a marzipan mm-hmm. company.
Of course.
So it was really cute.
Did you like it?
Yeah, it was delicious. Yeah. Now, I thought the last cue we were going to include was bringing down the wire card, this Netflix
mm-hmm.
documentary that you wrote about, this financial scandal that happened in Germany.
Yes.
So you must learn about all kinds of things being a film composer. You know.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, we knew, of course, about that scandal. We had deep knowledge about it because it was all over the press mm-hmm. over the course of the year that this happened. And it is up until today. There are a lot of podcasts dealing with the story about the diverse people that are part of the Wirecard process.
Yeah.
Scam. And and I mean, if you would write a script for a film like this, nobody would buy it because people wouldn't believe it. And but it was very interesting because the story was told out of the perspective of the Financial Times, a journalist who discovered all the stuff. And That's a perspective I didn't know about, because in Germany there's a different press than Financial Times in London, of course. Mm-hmm. And it was really very interesting to experience the story from a completely different perspective. And it was also interesting because I've been told I was approached because it was an English production company from London who did the movie, but they somehow thought it would be interesting to have a German composer because it's a German thing, and that's why they approached me. And that was really a very, very interesting and rewarding process.
And in terms of scores that are more electronic, and I understand it's best to have sort of more bespoke sounds where maybe you're recording instruments and manipulating them, or maybe using modular synths as opposed to just samples that are out there that anyone can use.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. But also you can do a lot of, like we call it in the box, just using samples everyone have and mangling them with different tools, or just misusing them in a way, and which makes for interesting sounds. So a lot of possibilities today with today's technology there.
So what's your favorite choice of those kind of options in order to produce something that people haven't heard before?
That's a hard question. I think what I really enjoyed was the process with The Flight of Brian, where we recorded a band of guitar player, drummer, and bass player, and then I took those recordings and cut them into pieces and used electronic tools to really mangle those recordings and create something new, but with the groove and feel of a real live band.
This is a clip from The Flight of Brian.
And I think that turned out really special, and it was a really interesting process, also because we didn't have time for such processes in general at that point, but it worked out pretty well, and it was also really rewarding. I mean, working with musicians, those musicians were all very good friends of mine, and I don't have the opportunity to work in that kind of style very often, so it was really cool to revisit the span sound and also the dynamic that happens when band musicians play together, and it just not just overdub parts one by one, but really groove along to a track, and it's quite different than recording them separately. Of course, it's like a small orchestra in a way, but with a bigger improvisational part in a way. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks so much for this today. I really appreciated a chance to sit down and talk to you.
Thanks so much for having me. It was quite fun.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leahroseman.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support this series, that would be wonderful. I'm an independent podcaster, and I really do need the help of my listeners. All the links are in the show notes. The podcast theme music was written by Nick Cold. Have a wonderful week.